Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Kelly Jean Kelly and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
The towns of Sandton and Alexandra tell a painful story about inequality in South Africa. The towns sit side by side outside the city of Johannesburg. But while one town is extremely rich, the other is extremely poor. Sandton is known as Africa's richest square mile. It has tall, shiny buildings and wealthy properties. Beside it, Alexandra, also called Alex, is a crowded black township that suffers from heavy crime. Alex was once the home of Nelson Mandela. "Even the air in Sandton feels different," says activist Tembeni Manana. She notes that many people travel from Alexandra to Sandton every day to work in its shops and homes. In Sandton, "the air feels fresh," she says, "as if people were using their air conditioners outside." But in Alex, she says, "the air smells like waste and rats." Angry protests took place in Alexandra in April, in part the result of campaigning for this week's national election. But the protesters' main criticism was not about the candidates. It was that South Africa should be far less unequal than it is now. Unemployment in the country of 56 million people has risen past 25%. There are tire-burning protests almost every day over the lack of basic services in mostly black neighborhoods. Whites still control much of the wealth, while blacks cut their grass and clean their homes. Fazila Farouk and Murray Leibrandt are with the Southern Africa Labor and Development Research Unit at the University of Cape Town. Last year, they wrote that they found no whites living below the middle class. Instead, whites have improved their economic states since apartheid because South Africa's economy sends such a large part of its national income to the top 10%. Farouk and Leibrandt wrote that half of South Africans are in homes with per capita earnings of 1,149 rand, $90, or less a month. And they have little chance to change this situation, even though they work hard as security guards or housekeepers. Tembeni Manana knows the feeling well. The 28-year-old activist works with the Greater Alexandra Chamber of Commerce. Manana helped plan last month's protests. "With us, we decided enough is enough. We want to challenge the system," she said. Manana presented a list of demands, including that schools in Alexandra should have 30 children for each teacher, instead of 70. Street sellers should be permitted to supply their products to food stores. This would help them take part in the larger economy. Children should be able to grow up in homes with more than one room, so family members have privacy. Criticisms like those discussed by Manana are not limited to Alexandra, but exist in many of South Africa's black townships. And this week's election likely will show how tired the public is of asking again and again for change. South Africa was once famous for its long lines of voters in the first democratic election 25 years ago. But that has changed. I think people are just tired of voting, Manana said. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
On a sunny spring day, a group of children, 4 to 7 years old, sit on their bicycles. They wear helmets to protect their heads and gloves to protect their hands. Their mothers, standing nearby, watch them closely. The children are ready to learn how to ride. Rachel Varn still remembers how she felt riding a bicycle for the first time. She says, "It's probably the biggest confidence booster. It gives kids such a sense of independence and agency." Now, her job is helping children experience that moment. Rachel Varn left her job of selling bicycles to become a trainer for bicycle riding last year. She founded Pedal Power Kids to teach bicycle education. Before starting a ride, she teaches the children how to make sure the bicycles are in good condition for safe use. She calls it the ABC Quick Check. A is for air, she explains. We have to check our tires before we ride. B is for brakes. We want to make sure our brakes work before we find ourselves on the top of a hill about to go down. And C is for chain. She says the chain must be clean. The rest of the training is more fun. The children learn riding skills from balance and pedaling to turning, starting, and stopping. And they learn to keep their eyes up and look ahead while riding. Varn says many children struggle to do this. They look down at the pedals instead. She adds, "Obviously, that doesn't allow them to see what's going on around them, and it also doesn't allow them to turn properly." Varn says watching where you are going helps you turn easier. Learning to ride a bicycle can open a whole new world to children. It gives them a sense of accomplishment and freedom. They become more sensitive to their surroundings and better able to make safe, smart decisions going from one place to another. Varn's goal is to get more children on two wheels. She says, "That's really a great way for kids to be active and develop healthy habits. It helps reduce pollution and just keep families and communities connected." Since starting Pedal Power Kids last year, Varn has helped around 250 new riders.
Google has announced new privacy tools designed to help protect personal data. It has also launched a much lower-cost Pixel phone. The announcements came on the first day of Google's I/O 2019 conference in Mountain View, California. Google officials said the new privacy tools would be added to many of the company's products. The changes come after Google and other major technology companies have faced repeated calls from privacy groups and lawmakers to take measures to protect user data. Google CEO Sundar Pichai opened the conference by noting that Google was seeking to keep up with evolving user expectations on privacy. One privacy change will extend Google's existing incognito mode to its Google Maps and Google Search apps later this year. The company says that when activated, incognito blocks user searches or movements from being stored by Google. Incognito mode has been available in Google Chrome and YouTube for quite some time. The company also announced a new version of its Android phone operating system called Android Q. Google says the new version will give users more controls over restricting how different mobile apps save information like location data. Android product director Stephanie Cuthbertson said at the conference that the release of Android Q is aimed at protecting security and privacy. She said location data recorded by mobile apps is some of your most personal information. Google has been criticized in the past for making it difficult for users to block location tracking. In 2018, an Associated Press investigation found that Google continued storing location data even when users turned off a location history setting on Android phones. Google also announced new privacy tools for its home-based devices. Such systems use voice activation and machine learning to answer human questions and perform user requests. The company launched a new website to explain how sensors used with these systems activate video and audio recording. Google says users now have the ability to listen to any recordings the systems make and to clear them at any time. The company also said it would not use video footage, audio recordings, or other sensor readings to target users with advertisements. After the announcements, some critics said they still do not think Google is doing enough in efforts to protect user privacy. They noted that the company makes billions of dollars each year by selling ads targeted at the interests users show through their search requests and data collected by Google apps and services. They're sort of marginal improvements, said Jeremy Tillman, head of Ghostery, a company that makes internet ad-blocking products. They are not bad, but they almost seem like they're designed to give the company a better messaging push instead of making wholesale improvements to user privacy. Mark Rottenberg is president of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He said he believes Google's privacy measures are too weak. Unless the Federal Trade Commission is prepared to bring enforcement actions against companies these promises to protect privacy matter very little. Rottenberg said. Also at the conference, Google announced the launch of its lowest-priced smartphone yet, the Pixel 3a. The phone comes in two sizes, with the smaller one priced at $399. The previous version of the device, the Pixel 3, sells for $799. The company also announced new features for its machine learning-powered Google Assistant. In the coming months, the assistant will gain the ability to complete a series of steps to carry out some internet processes on its own. In a demonstration, Assistant was able to fully complete entire travel bookings and buy movie tickets by itself. A similar Android system received a lot of attention at last year's conference when it used a machine-generated voice to set a haircut appointment on its own. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The election of Herbert Hoover in 1928 made Americans more hopeful than ever about their future. Hoover seemed to have just the right experience to lead the nation to more economic progress. He was an engineer and businessman who had served in the government as Commerce Secretary. He understood economics and had faith in the future of private business. On a rainy day in March of 1929, Hoover rode down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington to become the new president. "I have no fears for the future of our country," he told the cheering crowd. "It is bright with hope." Faith Lapidus and Bob Doty tell more about the Republican administration of Herbert Hoover.
The clearest evidence of the public's faith in the economy is the stock market. And the New York Stock Exchange reacted to the new president with a wild increase in prices. During the months after Hoover's election, prices generally rose like a rocket. Stocks valued at $100 climbed to $200, then $300, $400. Men and women made huge amounts of money overnight. Publications and economic experts advised Americans to buy stocks before prices went even higher. Time and again, people heard how rich they could become if they found and bought stocks for companies growing into industrial giants. "Never sell the United States short," said one publication. Another just said, "Everybody ought to be rich."
A number of economic experts worried about the sharp increase in stock prices that followed Hoover's election. The president himself urged stock market officials to make trading more honest and safe. And he approved a move by the Federal Reserve Board to increase the interest charged to banks. However, both efforts failed to stop the growing number of Americans who were spending their money wildly on stocks. Some experts pointed to danger signs in the economy during the summer of 1929. The number of houses being built was dropping. Industries were reducing the amount of products that they held in their factories. The rate of growth in spending by average Americans was falling sharply. And industrial production, employment, and prices were down. These experts warned that the American economy was just not strong enough to support such rapid growth in stock prices. They said there was no real value behind many of the high prices. They said a stock price could not increase 4 times while a company's sales stayed the same. They said the high prices were built on foolish dreams of wealth, not real value.
But the prices went still higher. Buyers fought with each other to pay more and more for company stocks. The average price of all stocks almost doubled in just 1 year. It seemed everybody was buying stocks, even people with little money or economic training. A clothing salesman got advice from a stock trader visiting his store and made $200,000. A nurse learned of a good company from someone in the hospital. She made $30,000. There were thousands of such stories. By early September, the stock market reached its high point of the past 18 months. Shares of the Westinghouse Company had climbed from $91 to $313. The Anaconda Copper Company had risen from $54 to $162. Union Carbide jumped from $145 to $413. Life was like a dream, but like any dream, it could not last forever.
In September 1929, stock prices stopped rising. During the next month and a half, stock prices fell, but only slowly. Then, suddenly, at the end of October, the market crashed. Prices dropped wildly. Leading stocks fell $5, $10, $20 in a single day. Everyone tried to sell their stocks, but no one was buying. Fear washed across the stock market. People were losing money even faster than they had made it.
The stock market collapsed on Thursday, October 24th, 1929. People remember the day as Black Thursday, the day the dreams ended. The day began with a wave of selling. People from across the country sent messages to their stock traders in New York. All the messages said the same thing. Sell! Sell the stocks at any price possible! But no one was buying, and so down the prices came. The value of stock for the Montgomery Ward store dropped from $83 to $50 in a single day. The RCA Radio Corporation fell from $68 to $44, down $24 in just a few hours. Down the stocks fell, lower and lower. Several of the country's leading bankers met to discuss ways to stop the disaster. They agreed to buy stocks in large amounts to stop the wave of selling. The bankers moved quickly, and for 2 days, prices held steady. But then, like snow falling down the side of a mountain, the stocks dropped again. Prices went to amazingly low levels. One business newspaper said simply, "The present week has witnessed the greatest stock market disaster of all time."
The stock market crash ruined thousands of Americans. In a few short weeks, traders lost $30 billion, an amount almost as great as all the money the United States had spent in World War I. Some businessmen could not accept what had happened. They jumped from the tops of buildings and killed themselves. In fact, one popular joke of the time said that hotel owners had to ask people if they wanted rooms for sleeping or jumping. But the stock market crash was nothing to laugh about. It destroyed much of the money that Americans had saved. Even worse, it caused millions of people to worry and lose faith in the economy. They were not sure what to expect tomorrow. Business owners would not spend money for new factories or business operations. Instead, they decided to wait and see what would happen. This reduced production and caused more workers to lose their jobs. Fewer workers meant fewer people with money to buy goods. And fewer people buying goods meant less need for factories to produce. So it went. In short, economic disaster.
Why did the stock market crash? One reason, people had been paying too much for stocks. Everyone believed that prices would go higher and higher forever. People paid more for stocks than the stocks were worth. They hoped to sell the stocks at even higher prices. It was like a children's balloon that expands with air, blowing bigger and bigger until it bursts. But there were other important reasons. Industrial profits were too high and wages too low. 5% of the population owned one-third of all personal income. The average worker simply did not have enough money to buy enough of all the new goods that factories were producing. Another problem was that companies were not investing enough money in new factories and supplies. There were also problems with the rules of the stock market itself. People were allowed to buy stocks when they did not have the money to do so.
Several government economic policies also helped cause the stock market crash of 1929. Government tax policies made the rich richer and the poor poorer. And the government did little to control the national money supply, even when the economy faced disaster. The stock market crash marked the beginning of the Great Depression, a long, slow, painful fall to the worst economic crisis in American history. The Depression would bring suffering to millions of people. It would cause major political changes, and it would be a major force in creating the conditions that led to World War II.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.